Are the New Testament Gospels reliable historical documents? How can a loving God allow evil in the world? You'll find answers to these questions in the Issues Etc. Book of the Month for April, Making the Case for Christianity, Responding to Modern Objections. It's published by Concordia Publishing House. Their phone number, 1-800-325-3040. Or you can find out more at issuesetc.org. The Issues Etc. Book of the Month, Making the Case for Christianity.
The fate of Eta Carina was sealed when it was born millions of years ago. When it finally does blow up, and who knows, maybe it already has. After all, we're looking at it by light that left the star 7,500 years ago. It will be a cataclysm unlike anything we've seen before. A hypernova. An explosion so powerful, it'll make a supernova seem like a firecracker by comparison. If there are nearby solar systems with planets harboring life, their days are numbered.
That's a clip from last Sunday's episode of the TV series Cosmos, A Space-Time Odyssey. Now, that Sunday's episode focused on exploding stars. We usually call them novae or supernovae. They happen very regularly in the observable universe, a lot of times, although very rarely in each individual galaxy. But if you add up enough galaxies, you get a rather common occurrence. What role do they play in the story that Cosmos, A Space-Time Odyssey is trying to tell about, well, really, the whole universe, from Big Bang to life on Earth today? Welcome back to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. Thanks for tuning us in live this Tuesday afternoon. It's the 29th of April. Dr. Danny Faulkner joins us to review Episode 8 of the TV series Cosmos, A Space-Time Odyssey, also to talk about a new survey on science and religion. A little bit later, Pastor Hans Feeney will be our guest. We'll be reading and understanding the Old Testament. He's written an article for the latest Lutheran Witness magazine titled Reading and Understanding the Old Testament. Our call-in number for the next hour, 1-877-623-MYIE, 877-623-6943. You can email us right here in the studio, talkback at issuesetc.org, or send us a tweet at issuesetc. Dr. Danny Faulkner is a regular guest. He has a PhD in astronomy from Indiana University, and he's professor of astronomy for Answers in Genesis. Dr. Faulkner, welcome back.
Thank you, Todd.
Cosmos, A Space-Time Odyssey is telling a story. It's not necessarily a sequential story from episode to episode, but by the time you're done watching all of the episodes, they will have told you a story kind of from Big Bang, the very beginning, to life on Earth today. In that story that they're telling us, how important are exploding stars?
Absolutely vital. You have to have exploding stars to account for what we have here on the Earth. According to the Big Bang theory, the universe began with just hydrogen and helium, about 3/4 and 1/4 respectively, and a trifling little bit of lithium, but nothing else, nothing heavier than that. And of course, living systems are composed largely of carbon, nitrogen, oxygen. That's the bulk, the mass of our bodies. But also, we have calcium in our bones, we have iron in our blood. We have probably a few dozen other trace elements that are important for living things. So, you know, the question is, if the universe begins with just hydrogen and helium, how do you get all the material that that we're made out of and essential for life? And the theory is, it's a really complex theory based on nuclear physics and a whole bunch of other things, but it's about the theory of how the stars get their energy. We think they're powered by fusion reactions, that you start off by fusing hydrogen to helium, down in the cores of stars. Once all the hydrogen's used up after a long time, then the star starts looking for some other source of energy. The star gets denser and gets hotter, and that then leads to fusion of helium into carbon. And then beyond that, you can jump forward through various processes. It's again a very complex thing to study. It takes quite a long time to kind of grasp all the ins and outs of it. But you got it inside the stars. You have to somehow spew that material out and spread it through space. And one of the more efficient mechanisms for doing that would be through a supernova explosion, something we've observed many times. And thankfully not close up, of course, because that's really kind of bad if you're close to one. And the star disrupts, blowing a lot of its material out into space. And the theory is that the products of stellar nucleosynthesis, those heavier elements, is mixed with the gas in space, which then repeats the process. More stars form, and they blow up after they synthesize material, and it repeats and repeats. And over time, you get this buildup of heavier elements. So today, they'd say probably 3 or 4% of the universe is made of the heavier elements, and things like carbon, nitrogen, oxygen, iron, things I'd already mentioned. And so that blowing up of stars is a vitally important step in that whole process. Astronomers generally call this chemical enrichment. You're gradually increasing the abundances of the heavier elements, and without that, life's not possible. Many people are saying that many astronomers think that life was not possible in the universe until many billions of years had passed. First 5, 6, 7 billion years, life probably wasn't possible in the universe because you didn't have enough of those heavier elements to give life.
So in other words, if you remember the periodic table that you studied may have just been completely confused by in chemistry class in high school, the lighter elements that kind of sit up, where do they sit? Way up on the
top. The hydrogen on the far left on the top and helium on the far right on the top.
Yeah, so you got these top elements that are very, very light atomically in their weights. And the stuff that gets heavier and heavier has to be the only place that the storytellers of cosmos and the scientific community generally believe that those heavier elements can come from is from the fusion of atomic nuclei inside stars and then blown out into the universe.
Yep, that's it.
Now, I used to think, that seems to make a lot of sense until I learned that it's not just one generation of stars. It's not just one generation of stars isn't enough to get us things like calcium or iron. There have to be multiple generations of stars.
Oh, yeah, many, many, many generations of stars. And the more massive stars are the ones that do this most furiously, both in terms of amount and also the speed at which they do it and blow up. So they're really looking to high mass stars to do the heavy lifting on all of this. But you got to have multiple generations. That's why I'm saying that in most theories of this, life is not possible until many billions of years have passed in the universe.
So talk a little bit about what was the subject of Cosmos, the Space-Time Odyssey. They did a lot of history of science here, and it is very interesting stuff to learn how it is that first these supernova, they've been observed for centuries, but were classified accurately, and then we begin to find ways of detecting them in very distant parts of the universe. What did we learn there?
Okay, well, I think I enjoyed this episode the best of the ones we've seen so far. I do stellar astronomy, so it's something I'm very keenly interested in, and I like the history of it. So we talked about Annie Jump Cannon quite a bit, and also Cecilia Payne Gaposchkin. She was those two women were really important and significant in the development or understanding of stars, first in classification of the spectra, and then Cecilia Payne in terms of understanding the physics behind it. And so those are huge people in the development of stellar astronomy. But then they didn't give a lot of detail about this, about how it came about with supernovae and planetary nebulae and all this kind of stuff. But Tyson did talk about that in some detail about how astronomers think stars develop. Low-mass stars would blow off their outer layers to form of what's called a planetary nebula and then leave behind a white dwarf, and more massive stars would explode and form either a black hole or a white dwarf, black hole or a neutron star being left behind with the outer stuff going out there. So he did a really good job, I think, of describing the current understanding among astronomers of how stars, kind of develop and how it kind of ties into this chemical enrichment. I mean, he was following pretty much the standard ideas there. I don't necessarily agree with some of those ideas, but it was very entertaining and I think well done.
How just for the non-scientists listening, including myself, how is it that let's say for instance our star, the sun, is observed? How are the conclusions drawn about how the thing works? What powers it? What makes it go?
Okay, well, our understanding has been for decades is that the sun's fusing hydrogen to helium in its core. We get this from nuclear physics. We have a very good understanding of how the atom works, the nucleus of the atom. The fact that we can run nuclear power plants, make nuclear weapons, and indicative of that, plus we could do various experiments in particle accelerators where we really look at the nuclei of atoms pretty clearly, and the predictions we make and the data seem to match pretty well. And so from that we can glean the kind of pathways that you can have, what kind of nuclear reactions are likely to take place inside of a star. It depends on the composition, depends on the temperature, the density, and all of this is modeled. I mean, these are computer programs. We used to do them by hand a long time ago, before my time, really, but done by taking the physics, as we well understand it, and cranking these models forward. And as stars age, they use up some of the fuel that causes chemical changes in the cores of stars, and then that leads to, at least according to theoretical models, changes in the properties of the stars. They can get hotter, they can get brighter. He talked last Sunday night about the sun increasing by brightness by about 10% over the next billion years. The theories also tell us that since life supposedly appeared on the planet 3.5 billion years ago, the sun's brightened by about 25%. That's an interesting little thing to consider and talk about, perhaps. But this is all theoretical, based on good physics, but again, theoretical. You can't test it in the sense that you'd have to watch a star like the sun for a billion years, or even, you know, a few hundred million years at least, to see any kind of difference. And we've only been looking at stars for a few decades. So as good as the physics may be and as good as the models may be, they're not really testable in the sense that we normally test physical theories in the laboratory with experiments or observation. Instead, what they've done is they've taken disparate objects in the universe, different types of novae and supernovae, different types of stars, different types of planetary nebulae, and they've attempted to put those little snapshots as they were into a coherent pattern interpreted this way. And I think people need to step back and realize that as good as our models may be, we think they may be, this still is a lot of interpretation going on into it. And I'm not convinced that we really have these models down pat. But you did ask about how can you test models of the sun. And one of the most important things we've had is one of the particles coming out of the reactions, a little thing called a neutrino. I believe he talked about that. If he didn't, he talked about an earlier show. These are mysterious little particles, but we can measure them. They're hard to measure, but we can do it. And we now know that the sun is producing the right amount of neutrinos as predicted by the theory. And so I have no problem with this idea that the sun is getting most of its energy from hydrogen to helium fusion. I think we now have data in hand that support that very nicely. Now, what was the sun doing in the past or what we'll do in the future, we can't say because we weren't there.
Dr. Danny Faulkner is our guest. Let's pick up right there on the other side of the break. We're reviewing episode 8 of the TV series Cosmos, A Space-Time Odyssey. It's Tuesday afternoon, April the 29th. Dr. Faulkner has a PhD in astronomy from Indiana University. He's a professor of astronomy for Answers in Genesis.
We are stars, we are ghosts, we are beloved.
Every week, Ravenelli's Restaurant and Carryout cooks up 29,000 pieces of chicken, 980 gallons of meat sauce, 310 loaves of fresh bread, and 200 fresh pies and cakes. Ravenelli's Restaurant and Carryout in Granite City, Collinsville, and O'Fallon, Illinois. Ravenellis.com, RAVANELLIS.com. Ravenelli's Restaurant and Carryout.
Hi, this is Pastor Clayton from Zion Lutheran Church of Muscoota, Illinois, a proud supporter of Issues Etc. I would like to invite you to a special event being hosted by Zion Muscoota. On Saturday, May 3rd, we're hosting a hymnody workshop featuring Pastor William Whedon, an Issues Etc. favorite. We'll use the historic hymnody of the church to meditate on the life of Christ. The workshop begins at 2 p.m. on Saturday, May 3rd, and all are welcome. For more information, visit our website at www.zionmuscoota.com.
Solid. Serious. Substantive. You're listening to Issues Etc.
Thanks to the following congregations for standing with us by joining the Issues Etc. 300. Pilgrim Lutheran, Santa Monica, California. Emmanuel Lutheran, Terre Haute, Indiana. Trinity Lutheran, San Angelo, Texas. Trinity Lutheran and Emmanuel Lutheran, Holloway, Minnesota. St. John Lutheran, Schaumburg, Illinois. Our Savior Lutheran, Pipestone, Minnesota. Real Lutheran Fellowship, Rochester, Minnesota. Living Word Lutheran Church, The Woodlands, Texas. St. James Lutheran, Logansport, Indiana. St. John's Lutheran, State Center, Iowa, and Trinity Lutheran, West Chicago, Illinois. Find out how your church can support this worldwide outreach by including Issues Etc. in your mission or advertising budget. Just go to our website, issuesetc.org, click support, and print a one-page flyer. When your congregation joins the Issues Etc. 300, we'll publicize your congregation on the radio, at our website, and in the Issues Etc. journal. issuesetc.org, click support, the Issues Etc. 300. Welcome back to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. On this Tuesday afternoon, we're reviewing Episode 8 of the TV series Cosmos, A Space-Time Odyssey, talking a bit about exploding stars. A question kind of lingers on that because you were talking earlier about how both the theory and the observation that we have been able to make, and it's a short period of both theory and observation in terms of our own sun and other stars, seem to fit, at least in that narrow sense, the model that of the story that Cosmos is trying to tell. But does that solid model of how stars work and what they do, does that necessarily lead to the conclusions that the storytellers of Cosmos are drawing?
No, I don't think so at all. I mean, we can put together models of how the sun and other stars now work, and that's what we like to call operational science. We can look at the stars as they now exist. This is a good portion, the good first half of this program. This week was about how we found out stars work. But what's going on beyond that is you're starting to ask, well, how did they work in the past and how will they work in the future? And that's where a whole lot of conjecture comes in. I think maybe overplaying the models quite a bit. I mean, I understand the physics a bit going on here, but I have to ask the question, if we've not really properly modeled them right now, and I have real questions about that, there could be little divergences here and there within our models that are not quite correct, then as you extrapolate that into the future, those little divergences from reality can become very important. I guess I'm talking about something called the butterfly effect. People talk about weather predictions, why they're so difficult into the future. We can do a pretty good job of describing what the weather is like right now, and maybe in 10 minutes, maybe in an hour or 2 hours, but when you start getting more than that, the farther you go in the future, the less uncertain it becomes. It's called the butterfly effect because people suggest a butterfly flying in China can move the air around a little bit that can just go forward, propagate forward, and cause very different weather next week or next month or next year because of the differences in the amount of air, that's the way the air is being pushed around. And so I think the theories we have work good right here, right now, but uncertainties, I think, multiply, and I'm just very skeptical, always have been, of how certain we can be 1 billion years, 2 billion years in the future. I mean, again, we know more about weather probably, but I don't believe a weather forecast a week from now. I've been disappointed too many times.
The other thing I wanted to talk to you about here is a recent survey from the Associated Press in conjunction with another organization that found, and there are a couple findings here that I wanted you to talk about. One is that about 40% of Americans do not have a real high confidence in the kind of the old Earth model, that is, that the Earth is 4.5 billion years old, or that life evolved through a process late in that time of natural selection. On the issue of just natural selection and the evolution of life on Earth, does it surprise you to hear that 40% of Americans are less than confident in that?
Not at all. I think surveys have also shown a great deal of belief in some form of creation in the United States. And if you're a creationist, then you don't need evolution. So that those two go together. I don't think they addressed that issue in there. In fact, they were spinning it in that story as a matter of scientific illiteracy. But I think something very different is going on. I think people are thinking a different way for a number of reasons, including some scientific ones. So it really comes down to a difference in origin, just starting assumptions of what you believe. And I'm not surprised by these numbers at all.
Another finding of the study that probably has all the makers of Cosmos and those who want to simply assume that everyone believes in the Big Bang is that about 51% of those questioned had serious doubts about the Big Bang theory itself.
Yeah, I think that would be disappointing for them. And I think they know about this because this week's episode is a bit different because it didn't do this, but almost every other episode, they've taken aim at recent creationists. I mean, they even mentioned explicitly 6,000-year creation, you know, coming from Usher or something like that. And so they're definitely taking aim at recent creationists throughout this series. And I think they want to blame the so-called scientific illiteracy in our society. Again, I wouldn't call it that. I'd call it people who have a different opinion about how the world came to be. Another problem I think that I've thought about is the fact that when you start describing details of the Big Bang model to a lot of people, I've seen it in the faces of some of my students. I've seen it in audiences I've spoken to about Big Bang. I get this look of almost like, you all are just making this up, because you start telling them some really bizarre things about inflation, for instance, and dark energy, and it sounds to the average person like all this rescuing devices you're putting in there. You got this problem with the Big Bang, so you just fix it with this little thing. You got another problem, you fix it with that. And it comes across to many people as very implausible because it sounds like you're making it up as you go along. Now, most astronomers would disagree with that assessment, but that's how it comes across to a lot of people.
Now, one of the things that I think the scientific community that supports the Big Bang model finds frustrating is it's not that they simply want these things to be true. They want the public to believe that, in the words of the AP story, they want the public to believe that these matters are settled scientific facts. What's your problem, if any, with that kind of conclusion?
Oh, boy. Well, whenever people start talking about a settled scientific fact, that concerns me mightily because you obviously have not won the argument, or at least you don't think you've won the argument, by persuasion. So now you're going to do it by intimidation, telling people, well, you just better believe this because we say so. That's how it comes across to me. That's a fairly recent concept, too. I've been around long enough to notice that that's something that's being used more and more, but it wasn't used much when I was growing up. And people, I think, who have a certain persuasion of an atheistic belief about how the world began were a little bit more respectful than they are today. I've been taking Sky and Telescope magazine since about 1970, and I've noticed over the years their attitude has changed. For the first few decades I was taking it, very few times would they even, you know, dare to take on people's belief about the beginning of the world. But anymore, they've become part of the advocacy for accepting the atheistic Big Bang evolution origin for the world. And I'm very concerned with that change in science in our society, that people think they have to get the masses, as it were, to fall in line or else.
I mean, just to talk about science and fact together, it was, and of course, I come totally from a layperson's perspective on this, but in the realm of observational science, it strikes me that they're not really concerned with facts so much as with, this is what we've observed, this is what we've been able to demonstrate by repeating those observations or by reproducing that set of circumstances experimentally. Draw your own conclusions. Here's the data. We will assemble it for you. We'll show you where it falls in the ledger, but the conclusions aren't left to the scientists to say, I just discovered a fact.
Yeah, it's a tricky thing. You know, people tend to think that the theories and facts are opposite to one another. They tend to think that if something's a theory, then it's not a fact. If it's a fact, then it's not a theory. But they're just comparing apples and oranges, really. A theory is a well-developed idea, a very well-developed, even tested concept. So the Big Bang would certainly qualify as some sort of theory, I guess. But then you collect data. Hopefully from the data, you sift out some things that you think are true or factual, and you use facts to support your theory. And when people start saying, well, this is undisputed science, this is proven fact, I think they're really overplaying their hand big time there. They're taking their interpretations of the data they've collected, and they're then elevating that to be unassailable conclusions that nobody could, a reasonable person, could disagree with. And the history of science is littered with those sorts of pronouncements. We've had many theories in the past, which at the time people thought were beyond dispute, only later to be discarded when embarrassing results came about. And I think it's really arrogant to think that here in the 21st century we've finally arrived at ultimate truth.
Finally, then, does it surprise you that at least in the press coverage of the AP survey on religion and science, that there was at least a coincidence asserted between people who have religious beliefs and their doubts regarding the currently prevailing theories about origin?
No, I think that's exactly what's going on. I think a lot of the doubt is coming there because people have different beliefs. They even if they're not born again Christians, they want to believe that this world matters. They want to believe their lives matter. They want to believe there's a purpose behind things. That leads them to some belief in a God. It may not be the biblical God, but they believe in a creator. And absent that, then this world's a pretty crummy place. My existence has absolutely no meaning or purpose to it, and most people can't live their lives that way.
Dr. Danny Faulkner has a Ph.D. in astronomy from Indiana University. He's professor of astronomy for Answers in Genesis. You can find out more about Answers in Genesis at our website, issuesetc.org. Click Listen on Demand. Dr. Faulkner, thank you very much. Look forward for next week's conversation.
Same here.
When we come back, we're going to spend some time with Pastor Hans Feeney. He's written recently in the Lutheran Witness magazine about reading and understanding the Old Testament. He says, you know, if you sat down and watched a famous movie like, say, Star Wars, with the volume down, you might get a general idea of what's going on, but you wouldn't know why. How does that correlate to how we read the Old Testament? We'll be right back.
It is the greatest adventure you could ever possibly imagine. It's demanding, it's hard, it's challenging, and what a blessing it is.
Dr. Larry Rast, president of Concordia Theological Seminary in Fort Wayne, Indiana, on why a man should consider the vocation of pastor.
And it is an incredible blessing to be honored with the opportunity to work with these incredible young men. And older men as well, who are committing themselves to the proclamation of God's Word, the right distinction of law and gospel, and to take the good news of Jesus Christ into all the world.
You can find out more about studying for the pastoral ministry at Concordia Theological Seminary, Fort Wayne, Indiana, at ctsfw.edu or call 1-800-481-2155. Concordia Theological Seminary, Fort Wayne, Indiana, forming servants in Jesus Christ who teach the faithful, reach the lost, and care for all.
Carpet, hardwood, tile, stone, laminate, you name it, they've got it. At Vallo Floor Coverings in Edwardsville, Vallo's offers competitive pricing, a knowledgeable sales staff to help you with product selection, and name brands like Shaw, Congoleum, Mohawk, Florida Tile, and more. Vallo Floor Coverings, 1009 Plummer Drive in Edwardsville, 618-656-7788 or vallofloor.com.
The saints at Gethsemane Evangelical Lutheran Church in downtown Marion, Ohio, invite you to join us as we receive Christ's gifts of forgiveness, life, and salvation, which He won for us in His perfect life, death, and resurrection. Sunday school for all ages begins at 9:15 a.m. with a divine service following at 10:30. Visit our website, gethsemane-lcms.org, or find us on Facebook to learn more about our confessional, historical, and liturgical congregation.
Providing artillery support for the church militant on the front lines, you're listening to Issues Etc.
There's a reason to be a believer in doctrine who sees that doctrine as having a practice.
Pastor Jonathan Fisk of Worldview Everlasting talking about his presentation at this summer's Issues Etc. Making the Case Conference.
And that these things aren't against each other, but that my religion as a Christian is highly spiritual, and my spirituality as a Christian is highly religious, and this is the best of both worlds.
You can meet and hear Pastor Jonathan Fisk making the case for being spiritual and religious Friday, June the 13th and Saturday, June 14th at the Issues Etc. Making the Case Conference in Collinsville, Illinois. For more information, look for the Making the Case logo at our homepage, issuesetc.org, or call Craig at 618-223-8385. 618-223-8385. The Issues Etc. Making the Case Conference, June 13th and 14th in Collinsville, Illinois.